Good evening, everyone. We start our new series tonight entitled The Law and the Law. I am asking for a better title, if you could help. As always, in the past, the series is sponsored by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib, and tonight we'll learn also Le'ili Nishmas David Froelich's father, Elchanan ben Shamshon. Tenishmasam Sirus Batsarachayim. So I'm calling this the law and the law. Law, first law capitalized, the second one not. And in a sense, it's part of the genre that's known as comparative law. It's an examination of the major Supreme Court cases of the last century and the Torah reflections on those cases. Now, obviously, the comparison is not a real or complete one for two reasons. Firstly, the foundations of the two laws are different. There's God's law versus man's law, and you really can't compare the two. And naturally, there are steady changes in man's law as we humans try to get it right, or as society's values shift from generation to generation. So that's why Supreme Court case law is never really settled. In some cases, more, in some areas, more or less, but many cases, not. So the first difference is that the foundations of the laws are different. Secondly, the methodology of laws is completely different. And perhaps we could add a third, in that the Torah law was meant for a society of Jews, Yirei Shamayim, God-fearing people, who have an intimate connection with the Creator. American law is not. It's meant to govern its citizens and provide for the common welfare. So on the one hand, the comparison is unfair. The scales are not balanced. But on the other hand, I think it affords us an opportunity to explore the Torah's thoughts on matters that we ordinarily would not encounter, if only to repudiate the idea that the Torah's laws and morality are synonymous with the New York Times editorial page, if not subservient to the New York Times editorial page, as so many Jews believe. So we'll look at a variety of different areas of law, the major Supreme Court cases of the last century, and look at the Torah's perspective, I should say more humbly, a Torah perspective on what those areas, what those cases would say. Tonight we begin with Gideon versus Wainwright and the right to counsel. This case, Gideon versus Wainwright, is one of the more famous cases of the last century, made even more famous by a best-selling book, you may recall, by Anthony Lewis, a disgraced columnist for the New York Times. But nonetheless, here he wrote a book, a dramatization of the case, called Gideon's Trumpet, later made into a movie in which Henry Fonda played Gideon. Now, Clarence, just the facts of the case, Clarence Gideon was a white drifter, a serial petty thief, an ex-con, dirt poor, who at age 50, in June 1961, entered a bar, a pool hall, in Panama City, Florida, and allegedly stole a bottle of wine, some beer, and some money, less than $50 in coins. He was arrested a few hours later. He was charged with breaking and entering, and other crimes. He just looked the part of a grifter who would burglarize a pool hall. He was eventually convicted and sentenced to the maximum, 5 years in prison. Seems like a lot, but it wasn't his first time in prison. Been in prison many times before. However, before his trial, Gideon asked that he be appointed a lawyer to defend himself, being too poor to afford one on his own. The court declined, the trial judge saying, and I quote, "Mr. Gideon, I am sorry, but I cannot appoint counsel to represent you in this case. Under the laws of the state of Florida, the only time the court can appoint counsel to represent the defendant is when that person is charged with a capital offense. I am sorry, but I will have to deny your request to appoint counsel to defend you in this case." Gideon responded, "The United States Supreme Court says I am entitled to be represented by counsel." Now, that was a bit of an overstatement on Gideon's part. What he might have meant is that, in a very general sense, the Sixth Amendment guarantees someone the right to counsel. The Sixth Amendment of the Bill of Rights says that every person is entitled to a speedy and public trial, to a right to trial by an impartial jury, to be informed of the nature of the charges against him, to confront the witnesses against him, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. That's the last clause in the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution. Of course, nowhere does it say that everyone else in society has to pay for it. All it says, if a person wants to have a lawyer, he's allowed to bring one, and no one can say he's not allowed to have an attorney. At the time of the case, the courts operated under somewhat conflicting guidance from the Supreme Court, in particular two cases from decades earlier. The first being Powell versus Alabama in 1932, better known to us as the Scottsboro Boys case. Maybe it's a very famous case as well. 1931, nine black teenagers traveling on a freight train in Alabama with a group of whites. No good was going to come to that from the get-go. On the train, a melee broke out. Most of the whites either jumped or pushed off the train, except for three of them, including two women who claimed they were raped by these nine black teenagers. One woman recanted her story almost immediately, but eight blacks were convicted of rape in one-day trials by all white juries and sentenced to death. They were only allowed to see lawyers right before the trial started, allowing no time to construct a real defense. The case was appealed. The state court rejected their appeals. Remember, it's the Old South. But the Supreme Court heard arguments and reversed the convictions, voting 7-2. Reversed, meaning the case was tossed and remanded for a new trial, on the grounds that their convictions were unconstitutional because the U.S. Constitution guarantees state defendants the right to counsel in a capital case, meaning where the death penalty is a possibility, from the time of arraignment through trial and appeal. So having been denied an attorney until right before the trial, their due process rights were violated. Due process is legal shorthand for all the rights the accused has in any proceeding. 7-2, the court voted to reverse. One of the no votes in the minority, one of the two, belonged to Justice James McReynolds, who had been Attorney General under Woodrow Wilson and was infamous as a racist and a Jew hater. He hated, also a Southerner, hated blacks and he hated Jews as well. Hated Jews so much, he didn't talk to Justice Brandeis for years. For years, just ignored him. And when Brandeis would speak at one of the judicial conferences where they conference the cases, he would actually get up and walk out. When Brandeis retired, so whenever Justice retires, all the justices send him a congratulatory letter wishing him well in retirement, he refused to sign the letter. And McReynolds went so far as to write to President Hoover not to appoint Benjamin Cardozo, so as, and I quote, not to afflict the court with another Jew. Supreme Court Justice, it's only 80 years ago. Well, the case was reversed and remanded for a new trial. Samuel Leibowitz, nice New York Jew from Lower East Side, took on the defense of one of the defendants for 4 years, pro bono, Latin for no money, meaning doing it for free, at great personal risk because he had to spend a lot of time in Alabama trying to defend an unpopular defendant in a very unpopular cause. The cases were retried, and despite the fact the one woman who had recanted actually testified that no one did anything to her or the other woman, most of the Scottsboro boys were convicted and sent to prison anyway. There were many appeals, most served some time in jail, but the case itself became a major civil rights cause célèbre. Part of the problem was that blacks were systematically excluded from almost every jury, and each white jury convicted. There was one case where a black was on the jury, and he also voted to convict. So one issue was left open. Powell versus Alabama had guaranteed the right to counsel in capital cases where the death penalty was a possible outcome. What about non-capital cases? So the court dealt with that 10 years later in 1942, Betts versus Brady. Betts had been indicted for robbery in Maryland. He requested an attorney on the grounds of indigence, and he was denied by the state trial court. He was convicted, he appealed, the Supreme Court ruled that Betts was not entitled to an attorney. Ruled 6-3, one of the six was Felix Frankfurter, who was then the Jewish justice on the court. He voted that Betts was not entitled to a lawyer. And the court ruled that the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, that states may not deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, the 14th Amendment prohibits the conviction and incarceration of one whose trial is offensive to the common and fundamental ideas of fairness and right. And while want of counsel in a particular case may result in a conviction lacking in such fundamental fairness, we cannot say that the amendment embodies an inexorable command that no trial for any offense or in any court can be fairly conducted and justice accorded a defendant who is not represented by counsel. Or, as we might say in plain English, what the court held was that the absence of counsel does not necessarily prove that the trial was unfair. It might in certain cases, depends on the case. But just because someone does not have a lawyer represent him does not ipso facto mean that the trial was unfair. It was this matter that Gideon challenged before the Supreme Court. Now, for a fellow who really had no education, he apparently was in contact with jailhouse lawyers for quite a while now. Every jail contains a library where prisoners spend a lot of their time. In his first few months in prison, he spent time in the library. He formulated his appeals that were all denied on the state level, and then he made it to the Supreme Court in today's unusual way. He just wrote a letter to them saying he'd been treated unfairly because he didn't have a lawyer, and they took his appeal on that basis. Many things have changed in the interim, which is often the case in Supreme Court jurisprudence, especially the roster. And we can't underestimate how, when we look at American law as, of course, man-made law, what a role that plays. Sometimes it's not a change in culture, in morality, in law. It's just a case of who's who. Who was on the court then? Who was on the court now? Frankfurter was gone. He was replaced in the Jewish seat by Arthur Goldberg, who heard the case. And Gideon, interestingly enough, was represented before the court, also for free, by another Jew who had briefly replaced Goldberg in that seat, Abe Fortas. Now, Fortas was later nominated to be the Chief Justice. He didn't win. And in 1970, he had to resign from the court after he admitted taking money as a retainer to handle an estate when Fortas left the court. So Nixon ended the tradition of having a Jewish seat. It wasn't a Jewish justice for almost two decades. Now we have three, and it's arguable whether it's any boon to the Jewish people. But I digress. In any event, Fortas essentially asked that Betts versus Brady be overruled. Bad law. And of course, that becomes one of the more, some would say lamentable, certainly intriguing aspects of this type of study. Not that these changes are necessarily unwarranted or unwelcome, but man-made law is subject to revision. And of course, very often in our world, that engenders the expectation that God's law should also similarly be changed when the composition of our court, so to speak, changes, a new generation, where new values emerge from the grassroots. And that's what you see sometimes in the deviationist movement, sometimes even on the fringes of orthodoxy. People say the halacha has to change because, well, they're used to the law changing, because that's how American law operates. Fortas, in his oral argument, said, I actually listened to it, you get everything online now, he said the basic difficulty with Betts against Brady is that no man, certainly no layman, can conduct a trial in his own defense, so the trial is a fair trial. And he asked, how can a judge, looking at the defendant, decide whether there are special circumstances in his case? You remember Betts versus Brady had said, in a particular circumstance, it might be that an absence of counsel is unfair. So Fortas asked, How can a judge decide? Does a judge look at this defendant and say, you look stupid. You look as if you were a moron. Therefore, I'll appoint a lawyer for you. That can't be. Part of the complexity, if not for now, was the issue of federalism, the limits of federal power in requiring states to adopt certain policies. And part of the reason why change was in the air was that by 1962, only five states in the country did not provide counsel to the indigent. Two of those five states were Florida and Alabama. Another interesting sidelight was that Justices Hugo Black and William O. Douglas dissented in Betts. Remember, Betts was ruled 6-3. Two of the three were Black and Douglas. They were still on the court 20 years later. So they had the opportunity to vote again and to see Betts reversed. They did have two bites at the apple. And in 1963, it was Black who wrote the unanimous opinion. The court ruled 9-0 that the right to counsel in any criminal trial is fundamental, but categorically there could not be a fair trial without it. Betts was reversed, and the findings of Powell sustained and now apply to all the states. Anyone who could not afford an attorney would have one appointed for him by the court before arraignment. There was a further expansion of this right in Miranda versus Arizona that we'll take up on the separate cover a little ways from now, about the right to counsel during police interrogations that we'll examine separately. But of course, anyone who's ever seen any television or movie show about an arrest and heard the Miranda warnings given, after being warned you have the right to remain silent, what comes next is you have a right to have an attorney present during questioning. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you by the court of law. And that, of course, is the outcome of Gideon versus Wainwright. Well, you have to take these matters out of the stratosphere of the courts and down to the real world. Gideon was ordered retried. He was retried. But once the court said that it's unlawful, it's unconstitutional to try defendants without the presence of counsel, immediately 2,000 prisoners in Florida were released because they had been tried without attorneys. Go live in Florida back then. The jailhouse door just flung open. Gideon was acquitted at his retrial when the testimony of the main witness against him was discredited. A cabbie testified he picked up Gideon, drove him to a bar, and he had neither wine nor beer on him. And all states across the country began providing attorneys to the indigent at state expense. So now we come to the question, what does the Torah have to say about all this? Well, the Torah view of lawyers could be somewhat misleading if we only focused on the Mishnah in Avos. We must begin with it, though. It's the Mishnah, first parak, Mishnah Ches, Yehuda ben Tabai Omer, Al Tas Atzmecha Ke'orchei Hadayonim. Don't make yourself into a lawyer, literally an arranger of the law, or even more literally, an arranger of the judges, what we call a lawyer today, Orech Din, arranger of the law, is what the Mishnah calls Orech Dayan, an arranger of the judge. So it's a not very subtle slap at the whole concept. To the extent that lawyers are perceived as arrangers of the law, they pervert justice instead of fostering it. So the Rambam writes in his Parish on the Mishnah, Orech HaDayanim, Hem Anashim HaLomdimis HaZdainus, these are people who learn law and jurisprudence, so they'll be able to be proxies to people who need advice in judgment. And they speculate different questions. They'll tell the client, Im yomar shofet kach, if the judge says this, you should answer that. And if the other side argues this, you should answer this. Also known today as prepping the witness. As if they're arranging the judges, the judgment itself, the litigants before them, and that's why they're called Orchei HaDayanim. Yirmiyahu HaNavi warns us not to be like that. That is to say, Shilmad echad mibalei adin tana shato ilehu v'yomar lo emor kach o hakhesh b'ofen zeh. It means to teach one of the litigants arguments, say this or deny it in this way. And even afil yadashu ashuk, even if you know that he's the oppressed, meaning he's right, and the other side is lying, and mutalo lalamdo tana shetatzile b'shumpanim, you can't teach someone what to say in any event. Let the litigant speak. Arav Vajabartanura says similarly, these are people who are orchim umisajim tainos bale din lefnadayonim, people who arrange and prepare the arguments of the litigants before the judges. She'osu la'odam legalos dino echa mibale adin velomalo asekach b'shvil shetizke bedincha afa b'shiyodea shedinimo. You can't tell someone, one of the litigants, say this so you'll win, even if he is actually in the right. Thus, we see other examples in the Talmud of critical statements of this aspect of law. Pasuk says, "Sifsaseichem dibru sheker." Their lips spoke falsehood. Elu orchei hadayonim. Those are the lawyers. Shabbos kuf lametesam and aleph. The Gemara says in Sota daf mem zayin mebeis, "Misherabu lochashe lechishos badin." When the whisperers to the judges proliferated, Rabba Charon Ach B'Yisrael, their increased anger in Israel, V'nistalka Shechina, and the Shechina left us. Well, it seems to be a primary function of lawyers, certainly trial lawyers, or even in the misguided Batei Din, which we should all avoid, the role of Tan, religious pleaders, who only raise arguments that support their clients. And they'll misconstrue openly Piskei Din for the purpose of winning the case, but not necessarily elucidating the Amita Shel Torah. This phenomenon that the Rambam speaks of in understanding the Mishnah is very common in our world, in the American system. Very recently, there was a book published by a professor of law at Boston University whose name escapes me. I just saw the review in the Wall Street Journal about 2 months ago, and he said the whole nature of law in modern times has been distorted by the way it's practiced today. He says nowadays the job of the criminal lawyer is to get the guy off. That's it. However it's to be done, you're supposed to win the case and not at all to seek justice, or he said as it was, say 50, 60, 70 years ago, to ensure a fair trial. So all the various limitations on police conduct that have arisen in the last half century, slightly longer, regarding confessions, searches and seizures, that win freedom for the guilty is, he contends, a renunciation of what the practice of law was supposed to be, and has given lawyers a bad name. Guilty people get off. No one said it better, in fact, than Justice Cardozo, who wrote in one opinion when he was on the New York State Court of Appeals, should the criminal go free because the constable has blundered? So the answer today is yes, and for 50 years it's been yes. Yet, from the Torah perspective, that is not so outrageous, because the Torah criminal procedure is so rigid that it's often difficult to convict. You need two Adim, you need Hasra, you need two witnesses who, for the most part, have to see and know of each other's existence. They have to be very precise forewarnings given to the accused. Is relentless and very specific and detailed cross-examination, so very often the criminal goes free, and not necessarily because the constable blundered, but simply because under the laws of evidence of the Torah, it's a very strict, very high standard. Now, of course, what counters this notion is the fact that God guarantees the system, and God, of course, can remove the thorns from the vineyard as he pleases. On the other hand, l'chadchila, the system has been given to human beings to enforce without under reliance on God. So we do see that in the Torah system of jurisprudence, there is this type of tension between the fact it's a very high standard to convict, and on the other hand, it's given over to man and not to rely on God to enforce the system. There's another major distinction that has to be mentioned in terms of procedure. The criminal justice system in America is adversarial. There's a prosecutor, there's a defense lawyer, and they vie for the affections of the jury, who is the decider of facts in the case of guilt or innocence. So it's adversarial. The Torah system is not adversarial. There are no defense attorneys because there are no prosecutors. Rather, cases begin when two witnesses come to court and state that they have testimony that X committed a crime. So the court actually sits in the role of both the defense lawyer as well as the adjudicator, cross-examining the witnesses and raising all possible arguments that might exonerate the accused. In fact, I've seen this, I've lived it myself, both when I practiced law in the secular system and as a dean in the basement of America, because very often there are no lawyers there. Or even if there are lawyers, very often we'll interject with questions in order to focus on what we as dayanim feel are the issues. So much so that the examination responses will come from the judges and the litigants, and rather than any statements or questions the lawyers are asking. So in fact, lawyers are not indispensable to the Torah system, and nor does the Torah have what we would normatively call a right to counsel. But yet, that does not end the discussion. Even under the Torah system, not every matter was first adjudicated in court. There are times when Beis Din, apprised of a certain matter, dispatched investigators to see if there's any substance to the accusation. Classic case, Ir HaNidachas. The city has been, or every inhabitant has been accused of idolatry. V'dorshin v'chokrin acheyedu b'raya brura. So Beis Din would send out investigators to see what the story is. And only then they'd report their findings. And if there was a prima facie case, the Sanhedrin would proceed. So too, there was room under Torah law for defense lawyers as well. Now, I should state that obviously none of this, what I'm saying, applies to a secular system. So we're not even addressing the issue of whether a Jew can be a lawyer. Obviously a Jew can be a lawyer, very easily be a lawyer in a secular system, certainly under American law. And since there are rules of ethics that guide and circumscribe a lawyer's conduct, so a Jew can practice law with a clear conscience as long as he's ethical. If he's not ethical, it makes no difference what profession he's practicing, he's just a rasha. But that's in the secular system. But even under the Torah system, there might be a place for lawyers and even for a right to counsel. And we have to get it in a somewhat circuitous way. Pasuk says in Yechezkel, Perek Yudches, he was talking about that every person is judged on his own. Parents cannot punish for the sins of the children, vice versa. Listen to the pasuk. Aviv, the father, ki oshak, gazal gezel och, the father oppressed others. He stole from the brothers, robbed from the brother. Va'asher lo tov aso besoch amov, he didn't do what was good within his people, v'hinemez v'avono, he dies in his sins. And what the father does doesn't affect the child. What does it mean, asher lo tov aso besoch amov, he did not do good within his people? So the Gemara in Shavuos, Daf Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph says, Rav Amar, zehabo b'harsha'o, that's a person who comes with the power of attorney. Meaning a person who comes and represents one of the litigants, that's construed as lo tov aso besoch amov. It's not a good thing. Why isn't it a good thing? Rashi comments, because zeh boba harsha, the person comes, acts as an attorney for another, umisaber al riv lo lo, it's a pasuk in Mishlei. He gets angry, gets all agitated about a quarrel with which he's not involved. V'shemo harishon noach lo, v'noach lo pshara yoser mizeh, sheno yochel lasos pshara b'momen acherim. Maybe this person, maybe the litigant himself, would have been more pliant. Maybe he would have come to compromise with the other side, because it's his money. But if he's there represented by an agent, by a proxy, by a lawyer, by a mouthpiece, by a hired gun, he's not going to want to settle. He makes it worse. And indeed, sometimes lawyers make it more difficult to settle. And trust me, matrimonial case is a classic case where you have to get the lawyers to try to work out their differences and then let the spouses work out theirs. But, listen carefully, Tosfos add that this is only when kishu osa b'shvil shehu awa mubal taina shemis amra riv lo lo. It's only when a person is intrusive, he's aggressive, he wants to get involved in someone else's affairs, so he runs to court and becomes the spokesman. Avot, Tosfos now. Kishu toreach lohavila chavero ma'osav shein chaver yachol etroach. When he comes to try to win for his friend the money that's properly owed for him, but the friend can't do it on his own, mitzvah kovid. It's a mitzvah. To try to help someone exercise his legal rights and properly enforce his claims when he can't, that's mitzvah kovid. And the ritzel writes here that sometimes lawyers make it easier to resolve cases, especially if there's bad blood between the litigants. Omer Hoya Mori Haravzal, he's mean probably the Rashba here. His Rebbe said, Did Makam Deika Shashk Tatab Bale Dini Matsmam, where there's the possibility of strife between the litigants, which happens every time. In Yadinu Zem Zeh, if they have to litigate against each other, the mitzvah nami ovid, mipnei darkei shalom. It's the ways of peace to try to remove the litigants as much as possible from the details of the litigation. That's why Chazal would, the Rabbanan would, or appoint a procurator to represent someone who's been accused or charged of something. According to the Ritva, the issue becomes one of efficiency and pursuit of justice. Where attorneys promote justice, then they are welcomed. In fact, the Mechaber in Choshen Mishpah, Kuf Chav Gimel, Sif Hes Vav, summarizes. Mechaber says, Vasher lo tov aso be'amov, v'pas mechesel, he did not do good within his people, Zeha Baba Harshah. That's when it comes with power of attorney. Bamed, Dvar Memurim, Kishanit Baba Tove Birachas. When both sides are in one city, then you don't need people to intervene. Let them come and speak their pieces. If the litigants, plaintiffs, venom, separate cities, arez osa mitzvah, then he's helping out his friend by litigating for him in the place where the matter is to be heard. That's the machaber. Listen to the Ramo. V'yeshomim de'ein chilut bein im hoya imo ba'ir olo. Some say it makes no difference. Tells us, of course, whether both sides are in the same city or not. Ela kol zman shamur shehu alamu baltainos. Any case where this proxy is a strong man and argumentative, that's misabel rivlo lo, then he's just intervening in someone else's quarrel improperly. If he intervenes to try to save the oppressed from being oppressed, mitzvah kovid. So see, in fact, the institution of representation, legal representation, is actually well grounded in the Rishonim. Because we see that if a defendant cannot represent himself, then it's a mitzvah to find him representation. The Sma, commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, again, Choshen Mishpat, Tezayin, the Sifkan, Tezayin as well. So the Sma says that you see, but they did incorporate many norms that you found in the jurisprudence of the times. So he writes that, Minik Poshet Hu Bechol Dayonai Ashkenaz. It was a common custom amongst all the judges in the world of the Ashkenazim to inform the defendant of the charges or claims against him. It's from the Shach and Sifi and Simon Yad Aleph, against the simple understanding of the Gemara. Rav Moshe says we, in essence, we rule like the Shach, including giving discovery material, advance notice of the evidence to be presented to the defendant. Every defendant must be given time to prepare, to seek out witnesses and evidence that supports his case, to prepare documentation. He can ask for postponement as long as Basin does not feel his delays are not a ruse. So obviously, someone who cannot fully understand his predicament needs assistance to prepare and to present his case. Hence, the legal profession. Now, nothing we've said so far relates to the concept that society has to pay for someone else's representation. But we do have very clear and compelling sources that profess the idea that, in fact, if a person cannot represent himself, then the authorized bodies of society have to intervene. So classically, a very famous Rishalmi in the third parak of Sanhedrin, Rav Huna, kad hava yoda zafu l'barnash b'dine, v'lo hava yoda le hava psach le, al shem psach picho le'ilem. Rav Huna, when he saw an argument for one of the litigants, and that litigant could not articulate it himself, he could not formulate it, then he said, the judge has to initiate and say the argument, raise the question, elicit the facts, based on the pasuk psach picha le'ilein, you have to open your mouth for the mute who cannot speak. So why not a lawyer? A lawyer would be almost the literal definition of psach picha le'ilein. So the Panim Yafo is commenting on the pasuk in Vayikra, lo sasu avo b'mishpat, that Rav Pinchas Halevi Ish Horovitz, 18th century, Poland and Frankfurt, looks like Yitzhak personally, okay. Lo sasu avo b'mishpat, he says it refers to the previous pasuk, lo si lo sedar dal berivo, hitzarech hadayim lehashros hashnei ba'alei dinim b'chvodom kedei shelo yistaknu ta'anosam. Very important phrase. The dayan, the judge, has to equate the two litigants in the way he treats them. So none of them feel that yistaknu ta'anosam, that their claims have been silenced. Their ability to raise arguments on their own behalf has been ignored by the court. Even though he's judging honestly, if he's not raising the proper arguments, he's performing an iniquity. If the judge knows something that should be said and is not being said, then he's obligated to raise that argument. That's psach picha le'ilein. This is also codified in the Shulchan Aruch, in Chashan Mishpat, Siman Yud Zayin, Sif Tes. The dying sees a favorable argument for one side. And the litigant, he's trying to say it, but he doesn't quite know how to put the words together in a way that's cogent and persuasive. And he sees that the person is getting all upset. He's trying to tell the truth, but he's getting all confused. Which, by the way, happens very frequently in cases. Witnesses on the stand, actually happens to presidential candidates in debates too. They just don't know what to say. Their mind freezes. They start confusing. They think they hear a question, don't hear a question. They think they're answering one way, they really want to answer another way. Sometimes because it's because he's so angry. You see this also too often. People just get so angry in the presence of the other side. You know, people wait a long time. Based not that long, courts are longer, but even so, it could be months, could be a year or two since the initial act was committed, and they're just waiting for the day in court, and they've prepared, they've rehearsed them on what they're going to say, and then they see the other person, they become enraged, like the red cape before the bull, and they can't talk. In such a case, simply because the guy is a dope, he doesn't know what to say, doesn't know what's a winning argument. It's permitted to assist him and to make him aware, to refresh his recollection, to ask a question that will lead him back on the right track. Mishum psach picha le'ilem v'tzarach lehisiyashe v'dover zaharbe k'dei shelo yik'orche hadayinim. If you're careful, it's a very sensitive, delicate area. See, don't be, you're not putting words in his mouth. He still has to testify. Still has to come from him. But he could be guided. You put up barriers and guide him. These are the issues you have to address, you have to focus on. And here the Pischei Tshuva adds something very interesting. He says, I am the Bach, he quotes the Shas in Ksuvas at Tehem at Beis. Here the Gemara is a case about Rav Nachman. Ubdu the Krevos of Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman had a relative. The case involved a daughter who was trying to get access to her mother's Ksuba money. The mother had sold the Ksuba while she was alive. You could do that, you know. It's a speculative document. Ksubas were 200 zuz. So he sells, let's say she wants the money now, doesn't want to wait for her husband to die. So he sells it for 100 zuz, or 50 zuz. She has money in the pocket, but for the buyer it's a gamble. Because if she dies first, there's no money. If he dies first, the husband, he gets 200. But you're allowed to sell it. See, the daughter wanted to reclaim the money after her mother died first. So Rav Nachman told her, say this. And then he said, what I do, we made ourselves into Orchei Hadayonim. Shamina. Debe'enu Adam Chashuv Ein Isul Larach Lefnei Hadayonim Rayos L'Zchus Karvo. But the Bach concluded that it's only an Adam Chashuv, a distinguished person who can't do that, because an important person will cause an imbalance in the testimony. He'll expect that his word should be credited or carry more weight than the word of another. Inami Lilma L'Krova Tainos Emes. He could teach the relative to say true arguments. But the Tosfos Yom Tov says, D'nira lo, kishe'eino adam chashuv, afil shelo l'krovo, if a person is not a distinguished personage, and he's not involved with defending or helping a relative, it's still permissible shari. V'shub hevi loshen Rashi, demuchach demeino krovo lo shari. Rashi differs, others argue, but in fact you can have an advisor. Now, if you have an advisor, and we see already it was well grounded by the time of the early Achronim to have a legal advice for people did not were not able to defend themselves or represent their cases, the question is, what if someone can't afford one? So if the rich can have them, must the poor necessarily have them as well? So, based on a principle that's enunciated by the Maharami Rutenberg, it's in Chelek Dalet of his Trubos in the Prague edition, Tuf Tuf Kuf Mem Aleph. He said that all legal and commercial dictum dealings are influenced by Hillel's dictum, Madaloch Sane Lechavrach Lo Savid. What is hateful to you, do not do to someone else. That is to say, the scales of justice must be equalized. That case was a case where a community assessed each person a certain sum to pay the king's tax, and a woman, wealthy woman, was assessed by both the size of her vineyard as well as the fruit it produced. Double whammy, like the estate tax today. It's not nice to do that. Whatever she has, you assess her once like everybody else. So that would lead to the conclusion, if everyone has a lawyer, then everyone should have a lawyer, even the poor. Because we see there are many ordinances designed to protect the poor in court. Both litigants had to dress the same. The judge has to treat both the poor and the rich the same. Lo sakir fanim b'mishpat. You can't have some person sit, another person stand. You can't be deferential to one side because he's a rov, the other person is not. You can't even ask for an escrow, for money to be put in escrow, if that will inhibit the poor from litigating. All have to be on an equal footing before the court. Explicitly, the Rivash writes in his Trubos in Reish Lamed Hei, this is late 14th, early 15th centuries, B'dine mamunus yesh machlokas bein agaonim im hanit bayocho lemanos entelar, shezeu toein, o murshe, shiitom bishvilo beveisten. In monetary cases, there's a machlokas in the Gaonim whether a defendant has a right to appoint an entelar, who's an agent, a lawyer, or a morsha, power of attorney, to represent him. Some say that if he does not want to go to Beis Din, he can. The Rif said differently, so did Rav Sadja. Listen to the Rivash. Umikol mokom, chezehu dafko, bedine mamunas. That's only monetary cases. They're distinguished between the two litigants, and it's only money. When it comes to capital cases, if you can distinguish, then it's the opposite. A person who's accused in a capital crime, and by the way, we don't talk about it often, but they judge capital cases in the Jewish courts in medieval times, also even down to this century in Europe. They tried capital cases. The non-Jewish rules never minded if Jews executed Jews, so it wasn't an issue. But if it warranted, they did it. So the nitba in dinin nefashos, kevin deba'ina v'shaftu eda v'tziu eda, since you need the community both judging and saving. And dinin nefashos, hakom alamdin l'schus v'im hakom alamdin l'chova. Him kein yochol lemanos entelar sheyitan ba'ado v'yelamed z'chuso. A capital defendant is allowed to hire a representative to argue on his behalf and to try to win his freedom, to raise all possible defenses. Because in any event in a capital case, anybody who would say anything on behalf of the defendant, even on the way to the execution, they would stop and listen to what he had to say. They would always stop. So then in a capital case, you would always have an attorney. But the Rivash says, even in a civil case, kol shekein shemiyesh l'toveya entelar l'lamed chova sheyuchal hanitba l'manos gamken lamed zchus. If the plaintiff is going to have a lawyer, then the defendant has to have a lawyer as well. The Rivash, if you think about it, is very reminiscent of the decision in Betz that mandated lawyers only in capital cases. Now on its face, Betz is not unreasonable, as society has to weigh a variety of interests in order to determine to which objectives it will dedicate its resources. But think about it, since in normative criminal cases under the Torah there is no such result as incarceration, there's malchus, but there's no incarceration, so there's less of an imperative to require lawyers at every stage in every proceeding. And of course, legal aid for the indigent is a very expensive proposition for the society, and different jurisdictions across America deal with it in different ways. But nonetheless, going to Rivash, certainly in capital cases, he's allowed to have an attorney. Based on the Marami Rutenberg, it's clear if you couldn't afford one, that's Madaloch Sane Lechaber Chosav, you have to find someone who'll be Malamed Swiss for him. But that pasuk, give me one second, that pasuk in the Mishle, Jack Rashi's Chayel, Psach Picha Le'ilein, El Din Kol B'nei Chaluf, open your mouth for the mute, for the judgment of all whose fortunes have turned, is very evocative of the Torah worldview. The judgment of a person whose fortunes have turned, the Malbim says, Ha'anashim she'hischalef mazalom v'yordu minichseihem, people whose fortunes have been overturned and they've lost all their wealth. It is Gideon. They have to be assisted so that justice is not perverted. Next pasuk, Psach Picha, Shvat Shotzedek, V'din Oni V'Evyon. Open your mouth, judge righteously, obtain justice for the poor and the impoverished. So if that would require assistance of counsel, so the Torah might very well endorse such a system as well. Yes? I mean the Jews. Why? The Rivash was Chachmei Sfarad. Nah, Rivash was Spanish. Spanish. He had to flee the riots in 1391. Go to Algiers. So the Rivash was Chachmei Sfarad. You see, pretty universal. At different times, they were treated differently by Christians and Muslims, but never that favorably in any event. So you see, in the ideal Torah system, in civil matters, the plaintiff summons the defendant to court, and each testifies and adduces whatever evidence they have. And even, by the way, in American law, it's the unusual case. In most civil cases, the indigent do not get an attorney appointed for them. That's only, but certain cases, I think in housing court, they will. But most times, if they want to sue someone, they find a lawyer works on a percentage. If it's a defendant, it's a problem. They have to actually pay out of pocket for it. Lawyers are not required, though, under the Torah system. In criminal matters, two witnesses inform the Beis Din of testimony, and the accused is summoned to court, given time to prepare, respond, and offer his own witnesses and defense. Lawyers are also not required. But in each proceeding, if an attorney would render the process fairer and more efficient, then they're permissible and sometimes even laudable. They can't, of course, lie and obfuscate. They can't be what Rav Aviner says on the Mishnah Avos, Ta'arovet shel sheker ve'emet, an interesting mixture of falsehoods and truth. Can't be that. If they only represent emes. But it's not unreasonable to maintain that if they cannot afford attorneys, even under the Torah system, certainly in capital cases, and maybe even others, then the Beis Din will provide an attorney for them. In the end, Gideon's trumpet can be sounded as well in the Sanhedrin. I thank you all very much. Next week, we'll look at the New York Times versus Sullivan and the famous libel law cases and how the Torah views libel generally in journalism. Thank you all for coming.